Yeah, I can hear you guys now.
Nice, nice. Excited to have you on the podcast, Coach McCarthy. Man, it's a great pleasure to, you know, be here and, you know, talk with you about hoops and what you've been doing for the game.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah, so just to start it off, just talk to us about your love of basketball and how you got to fall in love with the game.
Yeah, it goes way back. I mean, my dad played basketball, and I grew up here in Anchorage, and you know, grew up watching him and UAA, and that's kind of how I got involved in it. And he was coaching and things like that of my youth teams, and so I just really enjoyed it. Made me feel good about myself. I met a lot of friends through it, and that's pretty much how I, you know, ended up playing high school and college and professional, and now getting into coaching. So yeah, I've been real fortunate along the way.
Yep. Like, what was your process in trying to make basketball like your career and your livelihood, just going from high school to college, pro, and then eventually coaching?
I did it. You know, I wasn't necessarily encouraged along the way outside of people from my family. So, you know, when you were a little kid and you were supposed to draw, you know, the picture of what you wanted to be when you grew up, I always drew a picture of a basketball player. And I remember my teacher telling me that I needed to draw something more realistic. And I remember telling my dad that, and, he said, don't listen to him, and you know, it's just going to be a lot of hard work and things like that. But I'd say probably when I got to eighth grade is when I kind of decided that, you know, this is something I want to do. And I remember my dad pulling me aside and telling me, you know, if I wanted to go to college, the only way that my family could afford it is if I went on a basketball scholarship, and that he would hold me accountable to that if that was something that was important to me. So that was something I decided probably about eighth grade, and it was something, I learned, it taught me discipline about my goals and things like that. I had my whole career, I never had a coach for more than 2 years. So that includes high school, college, professional. And I went to a high school that had not made state in the history of their program since 1948, because I ended up going to high school in Oregon. And it was a small school that competed at the highest level in Oregon at the time. The highest level was 4A. And my junior year was the first time they had made state. And I remember after my junior year, I averaged 9 points a game or something like that. And I told my dad that I was going to be all state and I was going to be the player of the league and all this kind of stuff. And it was typical, you know, you hear the young kids talk about what they're going to do all the time nowadays. And it's like, man, you're tripping. You don't even know like what it takes.
That's the existence though.
and my dad laughed at me and he said, who's going to say that you're all state? You average 9 points a game. Like, you know, you're a role player on this team. And so I kind of like, that was kind of a dose of reality for me. And I wrote down all my goals on a piece of paper and I put them up at the foot of my bed on my dresser so that when I woke up every single day, I knew like, okay, did I do what I said I was going to do? Was I who I was supposed to be today? And at the time, Oregon, my all-state class, I believe I was the only player in the all-state class not to make the NBA for the state of Oregon for that particular year. We were loaded. I mean, we had Salim Stoudemire, Michael Dunleavy Jr. We had some really good players coming out. But my senior year, I was all-state. I was second in the state in scoring, and I had gone through – I had to quit football my senior year because my junior summer going into my senior year, I was recruited as a dual athlete for football and basketball, and I had hurt my knee. I tore my PCL in a game in Las Vegas for an AAU tournament and was told it was my ACL, and so all the coaches that were there watching me believed I had tore my ACL. And it wasn't until the Oregonian came out with the state leaders in scoring that I started to get recruiting again because the game wasn't it. I mean, there was no highlight films. I remember thinking, like, my sophomore year in high school, like, the internet came out, and I was like, this is the greatest thing ever. So that's kind of how I made it. And, you know, I'd be sticking candy wrappers in the doors so that I could break into the school and shoot hoops. And I'd wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning just so I could say that I was the only person working out at that time for no other reason than that. And then when I got to college, my dream was to play pro. And I did everything that I could. You know, I did everything my coach said. I was in the gym all the time. You know, I made a lot of sacrifices to be able to accomplish that goal.
And then in high school, what was like your best memory, like coming out of high school, playing around, you know, some of the best players in Oregon? Just talk to us about like your best memory in high school.
Yeah. We played Madras. Madras High School was pretty, we had a pretty dynamic league. We had, in our preseason, we had played Madras. Madras is a player that was pretty, you know, he was better at baseball. His name's Jacoby Ellsbury, and he's a starting center fielder for the New York Yankees right now. But the dude could hoop too. And they had come to our place, and it was my first varsity game. And I think my first three shots were air balls of my senior year. And this is after I put in all that work and made these lofty goals and all that kind of stuff. And I had 36 points in that game, which is, you know, for, you know, that amount of time in a high school game, 36 minutes is your game. And it was at like a point a minute kind of thing. So I, that was kind of my best memory, or just, it was the time where it clicked and I thought, okay, like I can do this, you know, I can be one of the best players. Yeah, there's a lot of heartbreak along the way. You know, it's usually one or two like good memories, and the rest is like, we could have won this or we could have won that, you know. But yeah, I think that was kind of that moment where I thought, like, yeah, I can make this a career.
And so, like, having that mindset of, yes, I can make it, talk about your recruiting process and how you eventually got to play at NNU.
It was pretty unique. So in the team Gonzaga team camp, going into my senior year, I had won the three-point competition. And in the three-point competition, I got to compete against their best three-point shooter, which was a guy named Richie Fromm at the time. And Richie Fromm ended up playing for the Minnesota Timberwolves. He was considered one of the best shooters in the nation. And I beat him in a three-point competition at team camp. And then I won the one-on-one competition, and I got to play one-on-one against a guy named Dan Dickow, who ended up playing for the Portland Trailblazers. And I didn't win that one. He beat me in one-on-one, but it was really cool. And I kind of got recruited a little bit by them. And I was kind of recruited all around the board. A lot of my recruitment had kind of come from the East Coast, and like, you know, it started out, like I said, as like a dual sport athlete at Army, and then a lot of the Ivy League schools like Dartmouth, Columbia, Yale, those schools. And what it came down to was I wanted to go to UAA really bad, and I never got recruited. And so I remember they recruited a guy named Mark Drake, and he was like on my list. Like anytime that we would play them, that's the reason I went to NNU, because I wanted to play. If they weren't going to recruit me, we were going to play against them. And at the time, NNU was very successful. They had just transitioned to Division II, and they had competed for the national championship. And my incoming recruiting class at NNU was me and four Division I transfers. So I was like, we're going to be loaded. Bring on UAA. Let's get up to Alaska and let's do this. And I ended up getting hurt my first practice. So I redshirted my first year. But it was a really good experience for me. And just to be able to go through all that, you know, just the whole recruiting process. You know, I didn't get picked up till really late. Like I said, like my recruitment didn't pick up again until that Oregonian came out. And I was, you know, number two behind Salim Stoudemire in the state of Oregon for scoring.
What was like the biggest challenge for you from transitioning from high school to college level basketball?
Defense. Yeah. Like you think, you know, and in high school, you think you play hard, and you know, I just didn't conceptually understand like real help side, You know, when you get to college, as good as the state of Oregon was, I mean, it was, we had the national player of the year in the state of Oregon. And like this team that won state beat a team with seven Division I players on their team. They had seven signees to Division I schools.
Yeah.
And I thought I was coming in like, you know, I'm averaging 20 some points a game. These guys, this is Division II. Like, you know, I was in for a rude awakening. It was like grown men. And that's the biggest transition is, you know, you have to learn how to play defense at the college level. There's a lot more thinking going on. And there's a big difference from when you're 18 and you're playing against a 22, 23-year-old grown-ass man. You know, it's and he's been hardened and he's consistently fighting people off of his spot. And you're coming in thinking you're just going to take it or it's going to be given to you, that you kind of get hardened a little bit. You know, I think that's the biggest thing about college is that your mentality has to change so much because everybody's been watching their own back for 3 or 4 years trying to make it work.
Sure, sure. And then, like, did you, as far as, like, working on defense and, like, what were some things during practice that, you know, coaches put you all through, a lot of different, like, toughness drills or things of that nature? Like, just talk to us about, like, a typical practice at that next level.
Yeah, I mean, it's different than it is now. I can't say that. And it's different on the men's side than it is on the women's side. But when I was a player, you know, it was a lot of like one-on-one competition at the beginning of practice. And then we would get into, you know, kind of like tactical type of stuff or like a defensive type of drill. But it's, you know, it's demanding the little things just for a long, you know, staying in a stance. I remember my legs would just be so tired because I'd never been demanded to stay in a stance, you know, for more than, you know, 15 minutes at a time or something. And that was probably the typical kind of structure to practice, you know, along the way. But, you know, there's one time I remember real vividly, you know, I went to go take a charge and help side, and the guy kind of stepped around me and laid it up, and we were in a scrimmage. And the next practice, I had to take a charge from every guy on the team. So I'd get up, take a charge, run over to the other side, take a charge. And like, you know, it's like I said, we got like 6'6", 220-pound, you know, grown men coming at me, and I'm, you know, 18 years old trying to take charges. So, that would probably be the one that sticks out to me. But, yeah, like I said, it's a little bit different nowadays because now you couldn't do that nowadays or you'd get fired at the college level anyways. So that's kind of the main difference. It's just not as hard-nosed as it used to be.
Them toughness drills, man. Them charge drills are no joke, especially because he's bro, man. Are you taking? Make sure your head is, your chin's tucked down. You know, taking it. That'd be the worst. Yeah, but man, so like transitioning from college to pro, what was like some of the funniest moments playing overseas that you can think, like some funny stories? You got it, like one funny story in the back of your mind playing
overseas? Yeah, we were. So I first got over there and. The team had signed me and they were really disappointed I wasn't black. Like the coach knew, the one of the other, you know, the owners and stuff. But I got over there and I met my team and they were like, you know, Schwarz means black and Weiss means white in German, and that was the country that I was in. And I kept hearing like Schwarz, Schwarz, Schwarz. I was like, what is that? What does that mean? He's like, oh, they thought you were going to be a black guy. So that was kind of the first thing. And, you know, for my first team, you know, when I was over there, I had one of my best friends on the team was Nigerian. And he understood, like, American slang. And so I could talk to him and I wouldn't have to, like, dumb it down, you know, a lot. And he could tell me, like, after halftime, because my coach would, you know, speaking German for a majority of it, he would tell me like, okay, you know, this is what he said. This is what he said. So I remember my first tournament, I get there, I get off the plane, I head to this tournament and we're playing, it's like a cup. So it's like every division, a bunch of different countries. You know, like, I mean, there was first division teams in Holland, first division, you know, from all over. And I go there, I play the first game. I'm after like 22 hours of flying. Coach says, yeah, you're starting. And I had a playbook that I was kind of reading on the flight over. So they kind of ran this, I don't know if you guys are familiar with it or not, but it's kind of a zipper series, ball screen from the wing type offense. And so I was pretty familiar with it. And it was also, I didn't play it, but I knew it because at the time, instead of 2K, it was NBA Live. And on NBA Live, you could pick your playbook, and I knew how to do the zipper series from NBA Live, the video game. So that's kind of like how I knew that. But I remember after the game's over, we win and we kind of advance on, and it was my first time kind of meeting my team. Well, there's a huge beer garden out in the back, and all my teammates, you know, a couple of the Serbian guys are smoking and a couple of the other guys are drinking beer. And I remember calling my dad and be like, you'll never believe this, but we got a game in like an hour and these guys are smoking cigs and drinking beers, man. This is crazy. So, but yeah, I mean, it's just a different culture, you know, over there. My dad had come for a game. This is probably my favorite one. Everything I had done professionally, it was, you know, it was something my dad and I shared, our love for basketball. And I had a really good game. I probably had 50 something in this game. And I remember I pulled up, it was a 2-on-1 fast break, and I pulled up and I had hit a three. And I coached the like amateur team associated with the club. And they were all in the stands and they all had these huge crates of beer. And I hit the three and I ran down the side and I grabbed a guy's beer and I took a swig of it and I gave it back to him on the way up. And they went crazy. They loved it.
That's cool, man. That's cool. Okay, so playing professional, let's transition into like getting to coaching. Like, how'd you kind of go about from, okay, I'm playing professional, now let's get into the coaching realm?
So I decided that when I was overseas, and I remember thinking, you know, I was making decent money at the time, but it wasn't good enough to, like, you know, retire off of someday. And so I wanted to make sure that, you know, I wasn't going to end up as like a 30-year-old man that had made a little bit of money, but not enough to retire. And I had no job resume when I came back. So I started talking with my grandpa at the time, who he had a job that I really wanted. You know, he made a lot of money. And I said, well, I want that life. You know, I want the boats and the houses and stuff like that. And I said, you know, how can I get in it? You know, he was a consultant for like big time car dealers. And I said, I want to do that. I'll do whatever it takes. I'll learn whenever I need to learn. And he said, you know, Ryan, this is not the career path for you. And he sent me an article on coaching. And how, you know, the coaches at the highest level, how much money they had made, and just their career path and how it kind of mirrored mine a little bit, and just their backgrounds and stuff. So what I did the next day, I went into the club president and I asked him if I could volunteer to coach what was their equivalent of a men's college team. And they hadn't won a game in like 2 years. And he said, yeah, no problem. You know, they're terrible. Go ahead and take over. So I started coaching them, and that year they had won their version of like the state championship. And so I thought, okay, well, I think I'm decent at this, and I want to, you know, continue to do this. So when I got back to the United States, I started applying for a bunch of different jobs, particularly on the men's side, but just kind of whatever was open. And I was willing to go to, you know, here at UAA or there was a place, St. Martin's in our league. And I remember emailing those coaches and asking, hey, I'll come and substitute teach. And I just want to learn. And I'll volunteer. And they just didn't have a place for me on their staff. So I ended up getting a women's job at the place that I went to college and became the assistant coach at NNU. And I learned a lot. You know, I was really fortunate. The coach there really let me, you know, kind of have a lot of different responsibilities in terms of like running camp. She taught me recruiting. I really got to understand like how the structure of a practice works and why you do the things that you do and what you're looking for in the recruiting process. So I learned a lot of like that foundational part of how to coach. And then when I got to UAA, it was like it totally changed, you know. A lot of things happened by chance here, but that was kind of how I got into coaching.
Like, what was the biggest shift going from being that assistant coach at your school to being the head guy, UAA? Like, what are some shifts that you had? What are some things that you had to transition to? Like, dang,
I didn't know,
like, I had to do this as a head coach, or just some things that you learned.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot more stressful. As much as you think you care as an assistant coach, it just means more as the head coach, just because you're ultimately responsible for whatever happens as the head coach. You know, you're, all the losses and all the wins are, they don't feel as good as the head coach. They feel a lot better as the assistant. But the losses hurt a lot worse as the head coach, and they don't. You know, I think the most rewarding thing is when you're able to see a player move on and start their life after basketball, and to be able to kind of chase down, you know, the dream that they had for themselves professionally. It could be a professional basketball player, or, you know, we've got, you know, a bunch of different professions, you know, of ladies that have gone on. But I kind of explain it like this. The head coach, you know, you get on the merry-go-round, and you let all your players and your staff on, and they go around, and their staff is making, you know, they're going from player to player, and they get to develop those fun relationships. You know, the head coach has to be business quite a bit, and, you know, it goes around four times. I push the red button. I let a couple people off. I let a couple people on, and I don't get to be in the moment with them, because I got to be thinking ahead of who we're going to bring on and who we're letting off, and who we play next, and is the ride safe, and all that kind of stuff. So that's the hard part about being a head coach. You know, I haven't ever really sat down and been like, man, you know, we've had a great run, or, you know, it's, I know that I can't do that, because if I do that, I'll lose my edge, you know? And so that's kind of how I think of it, you know? But I think that's exactly how a head coach feels. You can't be in the moment if you're going to be successful.
For sure, and just always, like, staying one step ahead and staying ready when, you know, like, everybody else. I mean, you have the blueprint as far as, you know, being you winning as coach in NCAA D2. You know what I'm saying? And those are a lot of gems that a lot of young kids and coaches that are listening to the podcast can take away from it. And, you know, I appreciate you saying that. And, you know, that's a great mind frame to have. And so, piggybacking off of that, you know, with your coaching career, you know, having your first year as UAA, like, going from your first year at UAA to, like, currently, what are some things that you've improved on as a coach that you think you've improved on?
I think a lot. I think my first year at UAA, I was guessing. You know, I was just trying to do exactly what we had done at NNU and you know, kind of apply that to UAA. And it wasn't really until my second year, I had one of my buddies come help me out, who was the assistant coach, and Alex Carlson. And he was on the men's side, and he and I had played pro together. We grew up in high school together. He was coaching on the men and the women's side at a Division III school after the staff at Boise State men had gotten let go. And he'd seen it all. I mean, he had been on a team or coached a team that had made the national tournament for men's basketball and lost to Louisville. And they were a second away from getting their contracts extended, and guy makes a shot, they lose, they all get fired, and they have to go, you know, other places. And he gave me a good perspective on, I hadn't coached inner city, academically challenged kids before. At NNU, you're coaching a certain type of kid, and that's not that kid. And I didn't know how to hold those kids accountable and make sure the grades were getting turned in. And, you know, I had to really think about, like, you know, we were recruiting girls with just no money, like, not like girls were living in their car and stuff like that. I couldn't relate to that. You know, not that I grew up with a silver spoon by any means, but I didn't have it that bad. And he had coached that kid a lot. And that was the kind of demographic that we were going after, at UAA, because we felt that was kind of a niche. We could get them, we could give them structure. We knew their athletic ability was going to be there, and develop a trust between us and between their coaches, so that we could kind of create some pipelines along the way. But those were the honestly, like, that's our people, you know, like, typically their coach is going to be an old baller who just like hangs out in the city, helps the kids, is passionate about it. That's the same kind of mindset that we had. But I learned a lot in terms of that. And then we came up with Amoeba on accident. Like, we were watching a Championship Productions video on Jerry Tarkanian. And he had this like crazy zone defense called the Amoeba. He was like, yeah, I think we should run this. And I was like, nah, man, let's just run it on baseline out of bounds plays. And he was like, all right. So we play Kansas State. And I remember thinking, like, we're going to get rolled. Like, we're going to get beat by like 30. And so we said, hey, if the game's at 25 or less, we'll chalk it up as a win. We'll go out to some barbecue. We'll have a great night. And we end up getting into Amoeba for the first two possessions because they were, you know, a jump ball and then there was some bounced off our foot or whatever. And we ended up with two steals and two layups and they had called a timeout. And I was like, hey, they're going to drop a set. So let's just fall back into Amoeba because they're going to expect us to go, man, we're going to see their best set, whatever it is. So we'll run zone. So we got another steal, another layup. We're up 6-0 at Kansas State. And I thought, just roll with it. So he's like 6'7", 260. He's a big dude. And in college, he had won a national championship. So he just kind of had that, you know, real competitive mentality. So we go in at half up 9 at Kansas State, running Amoeba that we didn't really know the full rules to. And our girls didn't really know the full rules. I mean, it's a straight guessing game. And he picked me up. We were walking through the tunnel. And he picked me up off my shoes. And we're about to beat Kansas State. So I'm like, oh, man. So I was like, we just ran with it. And then we ended up putting our rules in and putting in a press that we felt, you know, made sense. And, hey, ever since then, I think we're 185-17. And it changed my life, you know. So a lot of this stuff, you know, I didn't come up with. We either stole it, we fell into it. I owe Alex a lot. Coach Afoa has been, you know, real helpful, you know, and we always try to bring players back in that second assistant role that say, you know, hey, do you remember, you know, these girls are soft, you know, remember when we used to do this? And they're like, oh yeah, we did. Okay, let's do that drill tomorrow, you know. So it's just been, yeah, I've just been really lucky, man. I can't tell you, right place at the right time a lot of times, developed the right relationships. But I think the most important thing was that I found people that maybe they didn't look like me, but our hearts were in the same place. Like, we could relate through the game of basketball.
Could you kind of just talk about the importance of, like, your circle as far as, like, if I'm a hooper, you know, if I'm not hanging around friends who are going to play video games or going out every weekend to a coach like you? You know, you had good right people in your circle, and that helped you elevate yourself and put yourself in a position to be successful.
That's why I have a lot of respect for, like, the trainers and the mentors in this game, because sometimes parents just don't know. They want the right thing for their kid, but they don't know the path to get there, right? Or they don't hold their kid accountable because they don't know what it takes. And sometimes it's the kid, and they're hanging around people that just don't have the same goals. You got to think about it. If you play Division I basketball, there are 1.2% of players. You have to be in the 1.2% of players to play at that level. And that could be a, you know, Farley Dickinson, you know, like, it doesn't matter what level of Division I, 1.2. And then if you're Division II, I believe it's 2.1%. So you're talking about the 2% of all basketball players get to, they're not hanging around the top 2% all the time. So this has to be a person that is a little bit different, and they have to have someone in their life that's going to hold them accountable to that consistently. Because like you say, it's a lot of the time it's your friends or the people that you choose to, you call them your friends, but the people that you choose to hang around with are the ones that are going to kind of lead you down another path that doesn't lead to that 1% or 2% of players. So, you know, I think that's huge, but I think it's becoming harder because there's more distractions than there's ever been, right? Everybody has their Instagram and their Snapchat and all that kind of stuff to self-promote themselves, and they can lie to themselves easy, right? They work out for 5 minutes really hard, get it on film, and then they slack off the rest of the time and post that to their social media so they feel good about themselves, right?
For sure, for sure.
But it's also, you have more people involved in youth development than there's ever been, because there is a good market for it. It's a business. Parents want it so bad and they don't know the path, they're willing to pay people to show them, their kids, the path athletically. And I think there's a very good place in our game for that too. I think it elevates the game, because now instead of like the parent only worrying about their kid, maybe his or her best friend, now you might have a trainer that knows the way and they're working with like 10 or 20 kids, you know? And then I think the cream rises to the top in that group, rather than the two kids that know what they're doing and all the other kids are, you know, playing tetherball and that kind of stuff, you know? So, yeah, that's kind of what I've seen.
And then just like, you've been to the NCAA tournament multiple times, like, touch on that experience. Like, that's a rare occasion, you know?
It's a drug. I think a big reason that we've been successful consistently, you know, I don't think it's easy to be successful once or twice. It's still hard. But I think the hardest thing in basketball isn't getting to that level. It's maintaining that level. You know, the teams that continually have to live up to that expectation, I think they feel more pressure, because if they don't get it done, they're the team that screwed it up. And they always have that in the back of their mind, like, oh my gosh, they've made 12 national champions, you know, whatever. You know, if we don't get there. I mean, think about UConn women's basketball. They get a team that makes the Final Four, and everyone thinks they suck. You know, you got Oregon with Ruthie Hebert and a couple of girls. Ruthie Hebert could walk on water in the state of Alaska. They never won a national championship. But if a UConn girl doesn't do it, then they're like, oh, she's trash. She's no good. You know, so you're held to a whole different standard. And it's the same thing at UAA. If our team doesn't win the championship or make the national tournament, they're going to be like, wow, those girls are trash. Like, those girls played for one of the best programs in the whole country, right?
Yes. So
I think there's that. But the NCAA tournament, I always tell like the high school kids, you know, you think State Farm and Macon State is your goal when you meet with your team and you want to win the state championship. When you get to the national tournament, it's like that on steroids. It's you know, you're getting teams from like all over the country that you've never seen before. And it's, you know, it's not like the big leagues. Big leagues, the best team always wins. You know, it's a series of seven. Maybe the underdog wins two or three games, or they kind of make it close. But the best team always ends up winning, right? Even if they were the lower seed, the best team wins. In college, that's not the case. You get one chance. And if you screw that chance up, you might have been the best team, but your season's done. And the senior's career is over. And it's the last chance that you have to play for the name on your chest, because even if you play pro, you're playing for a check at the end of the day. Pro is not even close to as fun as college. And it's just like watching this day. Everybody would rather watch college basketball than pro basketball. At the end of the day, there's some pretty special players, but in terms of like the team, how hard they play, what they're about, what they're playing for, their stories, everything. There's no better level than college basketball. It's the best. And that's why it's called March Madness, because it's special. And, you know, our coolest time was the national championship game. We flew around on – the NCAA put us on private jets. I mean, I was texting – we were flying as low. I could text people the whole time. We were getting Panera Bread orders catered.
The Wi-Fi on the plane and the Panera Bread?
We have Panera Bread.
Living lavish.
They would walk around with these platters of candy bars, and you could just pick up. You know, my white trash got a hold of me, and I started picking off both the Reese's and the Snickers and everything like that.
Man,
we would fly into a private airport when we got into Indianapolis in a bus. It was like we were the President of the United States. A bus that had all UAA all over it was waiting. So we walked down the stairs and onto the bus. And then there's police escorts from that airport to our hotel downtown. And we didn't have to stop at any red lights in a police escort. So a 15-minute drive is a 15-minute drive. And traffic is just going like this. and our bus. I mean, everybody thought like this is, you know, the Cleveland Cavaliers. So we're going to the hotel, and each team got their own hotel, and they would decorate the hotel like the mascot of your school. So we get off the bus, we walk through the hotel. They're playing that 1980s UAA song, you know, "We're the Seawolves and we're ready to play," you know, that one. And yeah, that one, yeah. So they're rocking that.
That song during the Alaska shootout when I was a kid. Or I mean, the
yeah,
at the big UAA arena, Sullivan Arena. All the time during halftime.
So that's the song that we're bumping in that, and all of our girls get off and they're signing autographs and stuff like that. I mean, national tournament's a heck of a time. And it's, like I said, it's like a drug. Once you make it, you want more. And you will do anything in the summertime to get back to that place. I mean, it helps give you an edge, you know? So yeah, I mean, it's the best time of year to me.
That's what's up, man. Like, take us and just touching on staying ready and what was that summer like, you know, going after that first championship y'all had, what was the summer like? What was the summer like as far as development, as far as like culture, all of that? Just talk to touch on that.
After we had won our first championship, that was a very interesting year. We went 29-2. So we were 29-1 up until the point that we lost. We were number one in the nation. And we had gone through a couple of pretty big time injuries. We probably had the best freshman in the country at the time. And she ended up getting hurt. And then our best defender got hurt and our backup point guard got hurt. So we had, by the time we were still winning. So we maintained our position as number one team in the nation, but we weren't the same team that was rolling through everyone and things like that. So, you know, we lost in the first round of the tournament, and it was as embarrassing as a loss as you can imagine to be the number one team in the nation and lose in the first round. It's like Virginia. I knew how they felt when that team from Maryland beat them, Baltimore County. And it was just one of those things. You had to be honest with you. You know, when you step into the arena, just like a gladiator, anything can happen. And you have to accept the consequences of not playing hard all the time or not being focused or, you know, as a coach, not being fully prepared of what we were getting ourselves into and or getting your team mentally ready. And our girls and myself included, I took a week off. I couldn't get back. I couldn't go into the gym. And our girls are the same way. So that summer, everyone decided to stay. So every player on our team, regardless of where they were from in the United States, stayed. Now, we had like six Alaskans, so it made it pretty easy on that team. And then we had a transfer. Kiana Engel transferred from Boise State, and she was an Anchorage girl from Diamond. And she transferred, and it gave us another Alaskan, which made it a lot better too. And they all stayed. They all worked out together. They all got summer jobs. I think that was really important. So many kids decide they don't want a summer job, and they don't know what they don't want to do, right? Like, all our girls are, man, we worked for this moving company. It sucked, coach. I never want to die as a surf, right? You better get your degree, you know? So they had to like manage their time. They go make their money. They get their workout in, you know, they go hang out as a team, do whatever they do in the summertime. I don't really care. They would have a good time, but they knew that it was business. You know, at the end of the day, they could have their fun time as a team together, but it was work, work out, hang out, sleep, repeat the whole summer. And they came in machines. I mean, we beat that year. Pepperdine came to the Great Alaska Shootout and we beat them by 33 points. I had to take the press off in the fourth quarter. So, we were competing at a whole different level, and that changed. It raised all the bars of even what I thought we would be capable of, but it raised all the bars to set the standard for the rest of time. So now any team that comes in, they're measured at that bar, and we'll tell them when they don't meet it. But that's the team that kind of started that.
Okay. Let's go kind of like with all the success you kind of have, like, what are some things that you, that personally help keep you, like, level-headed, whether it's, like, a routine you do every morning, something you eat, read, like, what are some things that kind of help you stay grounded?
Well, my wife's a good one. And my kids, you know, I had gone through a couple of interviews. You know, typically it happens almost every summer, and I started off going because I thought, like, I get a coach at Division I, this will be awesome. And though the more and more I learned about it, the more I started to learn, like, you know, these Division I places don't really care about their women's basketball program, or at least some of them. And you know, they're not going to put the same effort in to make the women's program successful as maybe football or men's basketball. UAA does not have that problem. You know, our administration is extremely supportive. I get to work with some really great people, and I get time. And I get time for my kids, which is really important for me, and I get time for my wife, which is really important. And I think early on in my career, I sacrificed those things, you know, to get to where I was. And I was so laser focused on my career that I sacrificed relationships and my family and things like that. And to me, as much success as I had, it was really humbling because I had lost everything else, you know. So, that's kind of what's helped me keep me grounded. There's times I have to really check myself and say, okay, you know, like, hey, let's, you know, you need to make time for your family, your kids, or, you know, take your wife out on a date or whatever. But those are the things that are most important to me. And we had a guy that helped us out, Pat Flanagan, who recently passed away. And I spent quite a bit of time with him, especially the last 2 years. And he was an old baller. He played for, you know, Alaska used to have this pro team called the Northern Knights that competed in the CBA. So the CBA was the league before there was the D League, before there was the G League. And he was a draft pick of the Denver Nuggets, and he and my dad were pretty tight. And he just kind of gave me a lot of perspective. It's different, you know, when you have cancer, you're kind of staring at life through a different lens because you see the end. And it was really good for me to hang around him, to realize, like, I don't need to climb this ladder or let that be my only focus, because I'm going to leave everything else behind. So, you know, at UAA, I get an opportunity to, you know, get that time with my family, with my kids, with my wife. I enjoy being around our team. I work with my friends. You know, the Afoa girls are my legit friends. And I represent, this is my city, man, you know, like I, my state, I don't think a lot of coaches in the country get to do that. You know, I was born across the street from where I work, you know, like that means a lot to me. And, you know, the more I see people working in the city with the kids and stuff like that, just the more passionate I get about on my end of things, you know, to where we can help people out as well.
It really definitely hits home when your hometown trying to give back to community and help the youngins that you really grew up in, the land that you were born in, you know. And it's really dope just to see that you put Alaska on the map. It's really dope you put Alaska on the map, for sure, man. And so just final couple questions, man. What are some things, like, there's a lot of kids that listen to podcasts. What are some things that you would advise these youngins if they have goals of playing at that next level? Like, they need some guidance, for sure.
I think time management's a big thing. You know, whether you work out with a trainer or by yourself or with your high school team, your club team, you know, whatever it is, don't make that the only time that you practice. Yeah. You know, like, those people are the people that will give you the keys to the castle in terms of, like, these are the drills that you need to be doing on your own time if you want to be the person that climbs above the people on your team. Or maybe you had a training session with, like, five other people. You, no one got better than anybody when you're with five people. Did you do those same drills when you were by yourself? And then the next time you come to that training, that's when you take that next step. And they're going to show you the drills that you need to be doing, or, you know, show you, hey, make this a habit. If this becomes a habit, then you're going to become great at this particular skill or whatever it is. But to me, that would be the biggest thing, you know, and play as much as you can, you know, playing as many open runs as you can. Shoot, you know, when I got done playing, I had like problems, you know, like I was in like three city leagues. I remember I'd go to this, there was like a Latino church in Idaho. And on Sunday at like 2:30, dudes would be out there playing in cowboy boots and stuff. And I'd show up, you know, like I'm the, you know, me and my buddy would show up out there and we'd just play because we just needed, we'd had a Mormon run that night. On Sunday nights, we'd go to the Mormon church. We were at this Latino Catholic church. You know, I mean, we were moving all around to try to find the runs. You just, when you're young, you take it for granted. You know, it's easy, you know, it's easier to go to the rec center and you know, or you know, the, like you guys are doing those late night runs and stuff. Man, like, you don't get this time back, you know, to you need to do it now, especially if people are giving up their time to do it. And then work on your game on your own time. Like, show up early, stay late, you know, if you want to be great. If you want to be average, then do what everyone else does.
Facts, facts. And then, so let's say, like, I'm a young lady from Alaska, you know, how would I, like, what would be the best way to, like, reach out to you or kind of help get to that next level? Like, as far as, like, if I was interested in going to UA, like, what would be some steps to help me get there?
I think outside of the work, you know, the work part and being, I mean, if you're going to play for us, you probably better be one of the best players on your team or in the state for that matter. But be as invested, you know, we're going to find you and we'll be invested, but to be invested back is so many times, you know, like we'll talk to someone, hey, have you been to one of our games before? No. Well, you don't know what you're getting yourself into. You just want to play for us because we're good, you know? So I think the biggest thing is like, you know, if this is somewhere you want to play, be invested. Come to the camp, you know, get to know us and you know, show up to the games and show us that, you know, this is something that you really want, because the girls that have made it, you know, like a Tanae Valiva from East Anchorage High School and Tara Thompson from Diamond or Hannah Wandersee from Kodiak Island, you know, those girls, they were all successful, but they had a long way to go, but they were about it. Like, those are some of the hardest working players, and it were people that people wrote off, you know, like, you know, I guess the OG of the people that got written off was Sierra Afoa, and everybody thought, oh, you're a 5'9" post. You're not going to, you know, and I'm guilty of it too. Like, she taught me a lesson in that. But she was about it. And like, she would take other people under her wing, and Alicia Devine did the same thing with like Hannah Wandersee and those things. But like, they would work so hard. Like, these kids, they don't understand. You know, they were waking up at 6. They get their lift in. They go shoot. Tara Thompson goes 0-for-8 in a game one time. In a game. And I'm walking, you know, I'm getting done talking with the coaches. I'm walking to the gym. She's out there with her earphones in on the shooting machine, just burping up shots. We're talking about after a game. So how many kids are doing that? What? In the state? That's what you have to be about if you're going to come play for us, because that's the standard. Like, if you do that, you ain't going to be the first person I've ever seen do it. Like, that's what we do. So you got to be about it at that level if you're going to come play for us.
Yep, and definitely being about it in the gym, the classroom, and then for you, you're about it, man, as far as the coaching standpoint. Your resume speaks for itself. And, hey, man, appreciate you coming on to the podcast for sure. It was a good talk, man. It was great to meet you. Hopefully we can meet you in person here pretty soon, like after this COVID stuff and everything like that. And, hey, pull up to the runs if you can. We got one tonight, 8 to 10 p.m.
All right. Well, hey, I appreciate you guys having me on. You guys got my number, so just let me know. And what you guys are doing for the city is awesome. You know, these young guns need to take advantage of this because it's rare. You know, I talk with our girls from all around Ohio down to Hawaii, and they're not doing this. You know, Alaska's a spot to be right now, and you guys are a big reason for that.
Appreciate it, man. Appreciate it. If y'all ever need some training, you know where we at, man.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, sir. You have a good one. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, take it easy, fellas.
Sure, coach. Take care. Bye.